Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Dr. Roy Wandt, international, much awarded top researcher in mobility and ubiquitous computing, chair ACM SigMobile, and chair Mobility Tech Pack for the ACM. Roy, you just have this amazing strong background, a significant global impact in research and innovation. So really, we really appreciate you coming in today and sharing your deep expertise and insights and wisdom with our audience.
Thank you for the opportunity. It's great to be here.
Roy, can you profile your extensive research history and valuable lessons you wish to share from each of your top four research areas?
The first major project that I worked on in the mobile computing area was the Active Badge System. And this was a system which was designed originally for a telephone system which was built on top of a local area network, a kind of network which we call a Cambridge Ring. This was done at Cambridge University. And the idea was that we wanted to be able to route a telephone call to the right place. In other words, if a person was standing in one room, we wanted the call which was sent to them to go to that room as opposed to another room. And given that we had all this computing power in the phones for that particular system, you know, these were sort of telephones built on 68,000 processors, we thought it was appropriate to try and build something which was smart, which could do this. And so we tried to come up with a solution which would make this possible. And so the Active Badge was an electronic badge that people wore, and it was basically an infrared technology. It beaconed a unique ID using diffuse infrared and was picked up by a network of sensors around the building. And then information about which badges were beaconing where was then sent back through a simple network to a server, which collected the information and then made it accessible to other components of the phone system, which then could route the call to the appropriate place. So this was an interesting, novel technology at that point in time. In some ways, it's made obsolete today by the notion that we carry cell phones, so the phone calls go to the right place anywhere. Anyway, but at that time, obviously people used PBXs inside offices and fixed phones. What it did expose us to was a lot of the ideas behind what we call location-based services now, and the sensitivity people have to privacy for those areas. You know, there was a lot of debate as to whether people would want to wear such a badge, given the opportunity to wear one, whether they would, how the information was being used or recorded. You know, would it be used for purposes other than routing phone calls to the right place? So, you know, one of the lessons learned from this was that you have to treat privacy very seriously, and you have to engage with users and discuss and let them know exactly, you know, how things are going to be used. One of the techniques I used quite frequently was that, you know, I reassured them that any information that came out of the badge system was not entirely accurate, because if you were to take the badge off, for instance, and leave it on your desk and then walk away, then, you know, the system would think you're there working at your desk, and whereas you may be off having a cup of coffee or something. And we knew this, and so you couldn't put any reliance behind the data. I think this did reassure people. They could see some value in using it. Obviously, they would get the phone calls when they were elsewhere. We could also do, you know, some smarter things, like make sure we didn't route phone calls if you were in a meeting, because obviously we could detect that there are other people with you, you know, in the same location. Obviously, you could tie in with calendar and other information as well to get that information. So, so that was, you know, that was one of the first lessons. And then the second lesson was that you can build excitement. You know, once you've got the first few users wearing something like the Active Badge, and people can see, oh, it's part of this, you know, novel experiment, you can build excitement very quickly, and you can get a lot of people wearing it, assuming you've got over that privacy hump. But then, you know, the real lesson here is the trick is to keep value behind the proposition of wearing the badge. So for lasting effect, you really do need value, because, you know, after maybe a month or two go by, you'll start seeing people taking off the badges and not trying out the new features unless they actually feel that it's giving them something. And in this particular project, in this particular location where this was in Olivetti Research in the UK, where we first experimented with this, we did provide value, and you know, people could find their colleagues, they they could get phone calls they were missing. And it also opened up this whole concept of context-aware computing. I think people were excited by some of the apps which could be built on top of that. So we were continuously adding features and making it more valuable as time went on. So that was the first project. And this led me to another research area and another project called ParkTab, which is one which I conducted at Xerox PARC. And this was the very first context-aware computer. And the way I got into this was, you know, if you like, a follow-on from the badge system, in that it was an infrared-based computer. In other words, it communicated through infrared using microcells in each room. And as a result, you could tell which room the computer was being used in. And because you could tell that, you could customize applications to a particular place. And also, you knew which other users were using their computers in the same area. So you could customize data and applications to who and where the device was being used. So that's a very powerful thing, something which computers of that time, the PC, wasn't capable of doing, because, of course, it was a static device. It would be found in an office, and it didn't have this notion of mobility, the ability to move between places and determine where it is within those places and the context which it's being used. So, one of the things that we found out of this was that if you have a lot of people with these devices, they would sometimes turn up in a meeting. They'd be using them in a relatively small conference room. There's suddenly a big demand on the use of the bandwidth, the infrared bandwidth in that room, and at that point things would slow down to a point where it would become unusable. And so, you know, one of the lessons we learned there is that although for the majority of a day you might find there's no problem with the IO bandwidth, you've really got to design the whole system for the worst case of use. In other words, when you have one of those crowded rooms. The other thing we found is that it was a very extensible system. And some of the ideas that we had for how it would be used in the beginning were, they weren't wrong, but they really didn't explore the full capabilities that the system offered. And, you know, the lesson learned from this is that it's only when you build something can you really explore its full potential. The third thing is that in order to explore that full potential, you really need a set of tools which allow developers to go in there and build things for themselves. So in other words, the ideas that you have will, you know, probably go in a certain direction, but if you bring 10 other people in and you give them the tools so they can easily construct the applications that are required for their needs, for their tasks on a daily basis, and as a result they build them, you'll end up with a much richer system of applications which interact with the core technology and provide things which probably are useful for you as well as being useful for them. Later on, I joined Intel and I worked on something called the Personal Server Project. And this was a recognition of the trends in technology at the time, which were just becoming really interesting. So it was a recognition that storage in the form of small disks like the IBM micro drive and flash drives on flash cards were increasing in size, you know, exponentially in terms of their capacity. And as a result, you began to be able to store interesting things from a human perspective. And this is what I mean by this is that photographs and even movies were options or media options for being stored on these cards. And initially it was just a few, and then it was there was lots and lots. And if you just look at these charts, which describe the trends, you could see that, you know, in a few years' time, you'd be in a very different place, and the way you think about carrying around media and documents and even, you know, collections of videos would be very different. You would just do this. And, you know, the big problem with carrying these things around is then how do you access them? And the Personal Server Project really had this notion of changing the position of the client and the server device around. So in other words, rather than you carrying a device which you could access media which was stored somewhere else, as think of perhaps the smartphone does today, you're accessing media in the cloud. The concept was, well, if we have the media locally and we can serve it up to nearby displays and terminals, then we can actually have a full screen, you know, large screen viewing experience, yet we're carrying a small device on our person, which really doesn't intrude on us in any particular way. So the idea was actually to take an extreme view and build a device which was displayless, although it doesn't, you know, in principle have to have no display, but to push this research concept, we had no display on it. And it would form a local wireless connection using Bluetooth or Wi-Fi to nearby computers with larger displays. And we explored various techniques for establishing those connections and then interacting with the smaller device through the larger device. And I think this is an idea which still hasn't reached its full potential, because we're moving into a world where there are lots of displays around us. Displays are becoming cheaper. We'll probably find displays built into all sorts of things that we don't expect. And wireless technologies, local wireless technologies, are getting faster. And as a result, we can move those bits at lower power to these displays from these personal devices. And you know, my guess is that the personal server concept, you know, is a natural integration with the smartphone that we see today. And you know, it wasn't really until I made that connection, this is one of the lessons learned from this project, that it was hard to get this concept into people's heads and for them to understand the advantages until you really married it with a concept like the cell phone. So once we started telling the story in that vein, then people kind of got it and could see how it could be used, and basically how it could evolve from the trajectory of technology that was going on right now. The other thing is, you know, something like this is a little controversial. So you can imagine that there were lots of debates over how this technology would be used and whether it would be a viable use model, whether there really would be public displays that you could gain access in this way. You know, for instance, that display at the back of an aircraft seat when you're on an airplane, you know, might you be able to use that for your work? I mean, it's there. You know, at the moment it's customized towards the entertainment system. So, you know, would the airlines themselves open up that capability, you know, to just as people getting on the plane so that it was a resource that they could use? Would they charge for it and so on? So, you know, the lesson learned here is that if you have something that's at all controversial, be prepared for long debates, and also learn from those debates, you know, really listen to what people are saying and try and use it to basically take positions which you hadn't really considered before when you started the project and you started thinking about the basic ideas. The fourth area which I've most recently been involved in is something called dynamic composable computing. And this is the notion that the design of any particular mobile device or even a static device is limited in some way. It's limited by the form factor that it's designed for, its you know, the weight requirement that it might have, the size of the screen that it might have. So if you have a smartphone or a laptop computer, or an e-reader, for instance, or a TV, digital TV, then it's going to have certain advantages. It's going to have certain sensors and so on for its particular application. And it might be that the device that you have, that you're holding, doesn't have some feature that another device has simply because the designers weren't able to build it in under the price budget or because of the main use model. And it might, you know, it might be too expensive. So, so can you build a system which can advertise the resources that you have on any one of these particular devices and share them with the devices which are around? So, as an example, you know, supposing on your cell phone you have a camera, but on your laptop you don't have a camera, and that you would like to be able to use that resource on your laptop, for instance, to have a video conference. Then we'd like to have a simple mechanism for discovering that you have that camera and allowing it to be connected to your system and then integrated as part of your system. And, you know, imagine this has to be two-way, because it might be that the things on your laptop which your phone would like to share. For instance, an obvious one is the keyboard. have a high quality keyboard rather than a whole touchscreen keyboard. And also you might have multiple devices which are involved in the sharing. You have the TV and the smartphone and the laptop may all want to share some component. And there may also be devices on other people's laptops and mobile devices that you want to share. So you need to build a system which provides that capability. And our approach was to use a graphical representation of the devices and resources which were discovered, and then use a simple join the dots metaphor to make those connections. So by join the dots, what I mean is that if you have representation of a device and a representation of a hardware resource you want to share within it, then you simply draw a line using your mouse, or if it's a touchscreen, your finger, between that resource and the target machine. And then under the scenes of the user interface, you would then make all the appropriate connections and protocols in order to share the capabilities of that device. So so the issues and the lessons learned, I guess, from this particular project are that in today's environment, it's a very creative environment, it's very innovative, and there are things going on all the time. And we found that there are products which would share some or take some piece of this idea and it would be sold somewhere. So again, it made it very hard to make an argument for the project, because you felt like the barbarians were at the gates of attacking some piece of the city when you were trying to build the bigger picture out of this. And so you had to be prepared for that, and you had to be prepared for ways to defend that those issues. The other thing is that it's very easy when you start a project like this to think of all the right ways of doing something, but the reality is there's a whole legacy of standards and protocols and APIs which are out there. And if you're working, say, one of the most ubiquitous computing environments like Microsoft Windows or whatever, you really have to think about how you integrate within their world in order to better share these capabilities. And so respecting existing standards is an important thing. Don't start a project like this intending to reinvent the world, because it's just too hard to get traction. Even if you invent a better UI and a better protocol than something that already exists, the chance of you getting adopted with your relatively small project is small. So you really want to build on all the layers and standards that exist already. The other thing is that if you're building a demonstration system, say to show an idea like this and show the value of an idea like this, you have to deploy it, and you have to create a certain amount of infrastructure. You have to enable some of the static computers which are around, and digital TVs with software which has this capability. And you want to bring people by on a regular basis to see the research concepts and work their way through the issues. And just to keep it going is a huge amount of effort. You actually, for a prototype system, not a commercial system with a support environment or, a support phone number that you can call, you need to have a plan for how you keep it going and how you're going to maintain it in the face of bugs that crop up and system changes which affect your system, and you have to address it. And so just understanding the magnitude of the problem helps tremendously before you get into one of these fairly large projects.
Now, it's interesting. So what would you say then is the ratio between an innovative idea where you get some funding and budget, you get resources to sort of take it forward, but it really doesn't realize itself in a broader scale out in the communities, out in society in some way?
Well, I think that's very high. There are a few projects which really, in a research environment, take off and change the world. It tends to be, because there is a lot of momentum behind the systems that already exist. And although you may make improvements to certain systems, they're good enough for what they do. And these improvements actually don't make it all the way. And this sounds a little bit disheartening, but I think it's sort of the way of the world in many respects. But it doesn't mean to say that you can't, have point effect with something. There are lots of ideas which have come out of research, which eventually through some route have made it into products and incorporated into big systems. We're seeing those now. It's interesting, things like in the smartphone world at the moment, there's an application called Bump to Connect. And this is the idea that used accelerometers in some of the smartphone technologies. If you bump two phones together, the accelerometer basically recognizes that the bump has occurred at the same time on either of the two phones that have bumped. And as a result, you can use that to create a synchronization and to know that you need to connect them and need to exchange business cards. This was actually a research idea that came out many years ago in one of the ubiquitous computing conferences, and was explored in a research environment, and they had lots of variants of it. But that general concept sort of propagated through the community and then became what is now quite a popular app on smartphones, at least in some communities. So I think it's one of these things, small, clever, exciting ideas can eventually get out there. Larger system ideas are much harder, and you probably need a lot of luck and a big company backing them to make them happen.
Now, can you profile your current research and what you hope to achieve and the value to the broader audience?
So my current research, and I sort of take the last two projects that I've been working on, the dynamic composable computing project, which I described earlier, the value to the larger audience is that you have a set of devices which tend as products to be islands of innovation. And they really think about themselves as sort of an isolated closed wall environment. Whereas if you're a consumer, you buy all these things and you expect everything to work together. And mechanisms for doing that, I think are very ripe at this point in time. We know a lot of ways which we can make it happen, and it really needs the business models which you see around in the commercial environment at the moment to seize them and then take them forward. The value to the consumer is basically that the sum of the parts is greater than the value of the individual components put together. So, I see this as something which is a bit of a game changer going forward. And, you begin to see some of the effect of the Apple ecosystem with Apple TV and the iPhone. You're beginning to see some of the applications which companies like Samsung are putting together with their Galaxy Tab, their Galaxy Phone, and their digital TV products. Where they are beginning to have products that work across them. For instance, games which play on the large screen TV, but you may control some of the motion or some of the user experience from a mobile device like a tablet or a phone. Or, having videos stored on your phone and streaming it to a larger screen and seeing it on the TV. So I think that's the real value, is that we're going to see a greater aggregate value by bringing all these things together. And then more recent work, I've become very interested in the potential for NFC on telephones. So this is the standard called NFC, which is near field communication. And basically it's the ability for phones to communicate with other phones through near field proximity, basically communicating through inductive coupling of wireless components within those phones. It operates over a maximum of about 10 centimeters in the way that it's configured. The other thing that you can do with this, you can also read passive tags which conform to the NFC standard. So you can put a tag on something which, and the tag itself has a unique ID, and it also has some memory, so you can store information in there such as a URL or even a small text file or an XML file, and then read that information out of the tag. And then you can also write information to those tags, and if you like, you could leave a message for somebody else in that piece of memory. It's like having distributed memory, which you can stick all around in the environment. And, this is a new paradigm, a relative new paradigm, because, not that people haven't thought of using these tags for applications before, but it's a new paradigm because now we're beginning to see smartphones with NFC capabilities. So the Samsung Nexus S has an NFC reader in it, and it's rumored that one of the future iPhones will have an NFC reader in it. And NFC opens up the opportunity for automatic payment automatic connection, wireless connections between machines by simply bringing two devices together in proximity, perhaps making sure that you touch a particular place on the case of the other device. You can exchange credentials, which then allow you to make a wireless connection. And because of the physical proximity, you are able to guarantee that the connection isn't made or the credentials aren't shared without having done that, which you're pretty much aware of. In other words, it's hard to hack such a system. So, these are some of the obvious things you can do with NFC. Some of the less obvious ones are that you can make smart surfaces. You can create a smart poster by putting NFC tags behind interesting graphics, which bring up more information or allow you to buy things or interact with services. And you can use arrays of tags to understand where a smartphone is over a surface, and therefore have a coordinate of where it is on that graphic. And you can imagine that you can build applications which, knowing the position of your phone, can then activate other services or other information. So it's like a lot of new ideas. It opens up another set of ideas, and we'll see a lot of innovation around that in the near future.
So what are your goals then as chair of SIG Mobile, and what specific events and areas do you wish to spotlight?
Well, one of the key aspects of SIG Mobile, which is basically representing the mobile research community, is that we create a set of top-tier conferences and workshops which support the community. And we've been doing this for a number of years. We have 5 sponsored conferences, which are MobiCom, MobiSys, MobiHawk, UbiComp, and Census, and one annual sponsored workshop, which is ACM Hot Mobile. Part of the challenge is to keep these conferences vibrant, to keep them high quality, make sure that the program chairs and general chair understand what the bar is, and ensure that they remain guaranteed areas of excellence for the community. In addition to conferences, we also want to encourage the next generation of mobile researchers. And one of the problems with conferences these days and registration and so on is that prices tend to be rising, and grants and budgets tend to be smaller. So the one thing that we can do is that we can help reduce the costs of fees for student registration, and we can provide travel grants for students to attend these events. And in some ways, we sort of view this as, the seed corn for the next generation of researchers. We want to make sure that the students have access to these events. They get excited by them, inspired, and then, in terms of the profession, hopefully move in these directions, and then, of course, inspire the next generation of researchers. And then the final thing which we have on our agenda right now is to create the mobility tech pack, which is just about complete at this point, and will go out in the next couple of months to the community. And the tech pack is basically an annotated reading list, which covers all of the major areas or sub-areas within mobile computing, and provide extended abstracts for particular papers. The choice of papers is very important, as they are selected by people who really understand the areas. And if you only have time to read, say, 5 papers in an area which may contain 100 papers, these are the 5 papers that that you should read. So we hope that it'll be a resource which is used as a reference for students. We hope that it'll be a resource that if you are an engineer but you haven't been involved in mobile computing, perhaps some other engineering discipline, you wanted to get into mobile computing, then this would be an accelerated way which you could learn some of the key ideas and key directions. And also we hope that it will just be a general resource for people who are looking for references to support other research going forward. And the real test will be over the next 6 months to a year, when we'll see how many people actually use it and how many hits it gets on the ACM website.
Now, I was going to ask you more questions about the ACM Mobility Tech Pack later, but since you really introduced the topic here, let me just ask another question about it. And where do you see the value to the non-researcher, that is the practitioner, in the ACM Mobility Tech Pack?
Well, the practitioner probably is not aware of some of the latest ideas, the newest ideas. And we've tried to make sure that the TechPack has a spectrum of papers from, you know, perhaps an original publication in a particular sub-area, which everybody should know about, but then also some of the latest breaking results. And so I think, you know, a practitioner would look to this TechPack, perhaps scan to, you know, the bottom of each of the subsections and look at some of those papers and say, ah, you know, that's what might be coming down the pike in the next few years, and I should be ready for that. And of course, you see this sometimes in news stories as well, but you know, the advantage of the papers that we're referencing is that they are in-depth analysis of a particular idea or topic. Sometimes if they are systems which can be deployed, they're also user trials, so you get some idea of how a technology has been used and what people's response was to it when it was put out there. And perhaps even, you know, the shortcomings alongside the strengths, so you understand what the trade-offs are. So I think this is, you know, this is something that will be quite useful. The real challenge will be to get practitioners to be looking at this kind of material. Researchers, I think, just because of the nature of what they do, are inclined to read proactively, whereas it may be less clear that a practitioner should go to the TechPack to find out where the world's going. But you know, perhaps we can do that by appropriate advertising on the ACM website.
And I guess, you know, really you're getting the top people in the world really contributing to the TechPack and U.S. chair, and that's a big attractor as well.
Yes, we should certainly publicize some of the key reviewers, and you know, get them to endorse, you know, why certain things are in the TechPack. I think that's probably very important. Basically, to use them as recommenders, so other people respect what the recommendations are.
And are you going to be profiling some of the TechPack at any of the conferences that you're chairing as well?
We haven't got a plan at this point, but I do think it's a good idea as soon as it's available on the web to. Certainly, in the announcements, alongside the general chair at MobiCom and MobiSys, to make it known that the TechPack is out there, and we should probably have some sort of flyer campaign so we can send it out or send knowledge of it out to a larger set of conferences.
Now, I'm going to ask some questions in a sort of a broader sense about mobile computing, and the first one is about the total penetration of mobile. I don't know if you have some of this information, but you know, how big is the market? How many were shipped this year? What do you think will be shipped next year? What is the growth of smartphones out there? Are there regional differences?
Well, it is something that I followed reasonably well over the last few years because, you know, the trend in growth of smartphones has been absolutely fantastic. I gave a talk in early 2010 and was able to glean from one of the Gartner reports that about, you know, 1.4 billion phones had been shipped in the last year. And I just recently, you know, rechecked some of those numbers, and now the prediction for 2011 is that 1.7 billion phones will have been shipped in the last year. Now, not all of them are smartphones. In 2010, about 360 million were smartphones. Going forward, you know, we're seeing something like a 70% growth year, you know, year to year. So you may expect, you know, to be closer to, you know, maybe 500 million smartphones in 2011. But that's only an estimate at this point, and obviously the year hasn't ended out yet. But it's impressive. And if you compare, you know, that, you know, in 2010, if you compare that 1.4 billion smartphones with laptops, for instance, there are 180 million laptops shipped in 2010. So that's a factor of 10 over, you know, what has been traditionally, if you like, the mobile computer. At least, you know, the big companies like Intel are going to consider laptops to be a mobile computer category. And now we're seeing this totally new segment, smartphones, which you could do a, you know, sizable amount of your computing on, exceeding that by a factor of 10. Quite an extraordinary story and quite an extraordinary trend.
And I guess there's even a relationship between mobile use, and especially in developing countries, and increase in GDP of that country.
Yes, it seems that in countries which perhaps don't have great infrastructure, the developing countries, developing world, are really making use of smartphones in ways that, we don't, if you like, don't need to in the West. But for them, it creates the opportunity that they can build new businesses around it and compete it in ways which would have been impossible any other way. And it would take a long time, perhaps, to build the level of infrastructure which would enable it any other way. So we're seeing people who are basically running their entire business from their cell phone, and that's how they stay in touch with their clients, and that's how they interact with the rest of the world. They don't have an office as such; they just have their cell phone. And this notion of micropayments also has been something which, if you like, from a Western point of view, is surprising that it's so effective. But the ability to exchange money by sending messages between mobile computers, not necessarily even the smartphones. A lot of this was going on with the feature phone technologies as well. Smartphones, as they increase their penetration in these markets, will also help. But it's very clear that this is a game changer for lots of those regions.
And I understand that. I guess even in things like China, there's something like close to 800 million mobile phones in use.
I believe that's a close number. And also a region which things are fast growing. So I'm sure if it's accurate, it's already out of date in some senses by the time you realize it.
And I guess the total mobile use around the world is, exceeding 4 billion? Or there's more than 4 billion units? I think people say there's more mobile phone use than there are people with shoes.
Yes. I remember I gave a talk in 2007, and I think at that point there were 3.3 billion subscribers. That was half the world's population. And I believe the number of subscribers on record now is close to 6 billion. Obviously that's towards the population of the earth, but that doesn't mean everybody has a cell phone. It just means that there's that many subscribers. So people may have, several accounts as well.
That's pretty amazing numbers. And you think that, this technology also enables people to access the internet often, so.
Yes. So that's something which I think is interesting from the point of view that, feature phones give you some basic capability to access the internet. And of course, if you ever use a smartphone, with a modern browser, on those phones, then you open up, a very rich environment where it's difficult to go back, to some of those older generation phones. And I think this is what's going to really drive smartphone adoption, is that the developing world is going to be desperate to get hold of these because of the increase in value that they have. If the demand goes up, the price hopefully falls because they're expensive, and that's really what's stopping them getting to those regions at the moment. If we can see a significant drop in price, then I'm sure the adoption would just explode, and the two will probably go hand in hand.
Now, can you profile then this sort of idea of the visions of mobile computing?
Well, there have been a lot of visionaries in this area. So let me just pick on a couple of visions, which I think have been very powerful. So one of them was Mark Weiser's vision, who was at Xerox PARC, and he wrote a famous article in September 1991 for Scientific American, and that was The Computer for the 21st Century. And in that, he described what has become known as the vision of ubiquitous computing. And the basic concept is that we will begin to live in a world where computation is with us always. It will be embedded in the devices that we use for our everyday tasks. They'll seamlessly communicate with each other. They'll share data. And he really advocated the position that it was very important that you made the technology itself fade into the background. And, by that he means that if you consider the PC scenario that was prevalent at the time when you wrote this in 1991, where you sit in front of your PC and you're focused on it, you have your hands in front of you and you're typing, and that was, that was a model of computing. In the future, you've now embedded the computing in the devices that you use. So we've already seen this, with the smartphone and the something like an e-reader from Amazon, where you actually have a computer which is behind a device which in itself is dedicated to a particular task. So you are interacting with something which is giving you a book experience, and you're not having to deal with the operating system or reboot it in some, because some strange error condition has occurred. It's just serving you in that particular function. And so he believed that it was very important as we went forward that we build protocols and user interfaces and system interaction which deliberately stepped into the background. And I don't think we're there yet, but with examples like the e-readers and some of the applications which we now see on our phones and the integration of computing with televisions, for instance, are all helping us move in that direction. I think the most successful user interfaces are ones that disappear. You know, the community of, if you like, computer scientists are a special close-knit one, and they often are prepared to put up with all sorts of things. But if you're trying to expand the market to the larger community, then they really don't want to deal with the core computing issues. They want to deal with a very easy to understand, pleasant user experience. And that really is, I think, where Mark was going with the vision. It's a relatively simple idea, but it has inspired a lot of research, and you find that many of the white papers that we see that look at the challenges of computing so always reference back to Mark's work. And in fact, it's one of the papers that we feature on the Tech Pack as well. I could just highlight another area which I think has had a lot of, certainly a lot of press, and I think it's something that hasn't really seen its day yet, but it's the vision of the Internet of Things. So, of course, we have the Internet, which is the virtual Internet of web pages, which we're all familiar with. But the concept of the Internet of Things is that everything, literally everything, can have a web page. And if you use tagging technologies, such as NFC that I talked about, but there are other forms of NFC in the more general topic called radio frequency identification, in which you can basically put a tiny tag in everything, then if you bring a computer near any device, you can get information about, for instance, how to use it, where it came from, who owned it before, what services might support it, how to get it fixed if it was broken, something about the original cost. So a wealth of things which you could really do. You could also embed sensors in objects which are connected to these tagging technologies, which then record the state of the environment. And the sensing information can be picked up by a computer which is near it, which then reads the tag and records, you know, what the state of the sensor was. I mean, a sort of classic one might be, you know, something which may spoil in transit. There's some chemical which changes state, it's connected to the tag. When you read the tag, you find out whether the temperature range was out of, the specified range that would, the thing was meant to be shipped with, you know, a food item of some kind. And as a result, the device, you know, the object literally tells you through your computer, that the shipping conditions were not ideal. So the whole world can be part of this Internet of Things, and I think this is going to be another revolution that we'll see at some point in the future. Perhaps it will be very slow, and it won't be like it sort of happens one day, but I think it will happen, and as a result, I think we'll be able to organize and interact, and even for inanimate objects, you know, have a richly connected experience with the whole of the Internet and our mobile computing setups that we have at the moment.
Yeah, it's a fascinating discussion. So do you ever sort of, and this is really controversial, right, this idea of a singularity from Kurzweil, do you really see it moving in that direction at some point?
So the singularity, the idea that we're accelerating along all of these trends, and at some point the graphs will go vertical, and perhaps even machines will begin to think and so on. So I think that's the basic concept that he advocates. It's certainly the case that a lot of these graphs are going to go pretty steep. It's really hard to understand whether we're just not on the acceleration, you know, part of the curve, and we're going to tail off. The interesting thing for any single technology, you know, there does seem to be an S curve in place. So initially things are slow, and then we accelerate, perhaps, you know, exponentially, and then often a technology peters out, and we see this, you know, even with something like like storage, where we've seen exponential growth over the years. In fact, the interesting thing is there that the technology has changed several times throughout the creation of electronic storage. And, you know, just when one was petering out, fortunately, innovation came along and found some other technologies which then took off, like magnetoresistance or something of this kind. And so it really depends whether there is an innovation to fill the gap, because I think most things will peter out, and you need that extra innovation coming in. Now, I think the exciting thing about the whole connected world, the internet, the additional connectivity that mobility gives you, is that there are far more people in the game now than there were before, and as a result, that the chance of innovation is much higher. So perhaps there is a good chance that we can keep all those exponential growth curves going, simply because there's more people thinking of solutions to some of these, you know, tantalizing problems. I don't know whether it will truly go asymptotic, but at least for a number of years, I think we're going to see tremendous growth.
Now, in terms of mobile again, what are the current challenges for mobile, I should say, and for 2012?
Well, I think, you know, one of the key things that's happened with the explosion of mobile phones and mobile apps is that you've opened up the security hole, right? Initially, they were a small market, and they weren't a big target for people who wanted to create malware and viruses and so on. But, of course, that's all changed in the last couple of years. And now we're seeing a lot of these kinds of aberrant viruses and programs which are affecting mobile phones. And, you know, part of the challenge is how do you detect them, or how do you lock down an application when you load it? And there haven't been, I think, very successful solutions to date. You know, for instance, on some of the phones, when you install an application, it may say that it requires access to certain resources, it may say it requires access to the internet, and so on. But, you know, that really isn't a fine enough control to actually lock down what it's going to do. I mean, almost everything needs access to the internet, and it could be for good or bad purposes. It could be sending you know, private information across it, or it could be talking to a legitimate service. So we really need tools which are installed on the devices which monitor the activity of certain applications. And we also need, I think, finer-grained control over what applications are allowed to do. But the challenge is, of course, that you have to do that in a way which users will find it acceptable to go through the process of installation. I mean, how many times have people just ignored the licensing agreement and ignored instructions, basically, to get to the point where they can run their app as they're installing it? I think a lot of people would just click through without thinking about many of the issues as they go through that process. You know, so how could you set up safeguards which would choose appropriate default for your phone and only alert you to issues, you know, when it was really critical? So in other words, don't bother you all the time because you'll probably ignore it, but just, you know, tell you about some of the things that you really need to pay attention to. So I think we're going to see a lot of innovation in that area. Obviously, if I knew the solution now, it wouldn't be an area of research, but I think it's going to be a very significant area for researchers to get involved in over the next few years. One of the other, I think, big challenges is power consumption. So we're putting, you know, more powerful processors into phones. Obviously, they can be using new technologies, new silicon technologies, which help reduce power. But ultimately, you know, we're putting multi-core components in these phones, and we are going to see that power is an issue. So we need to manage power very well. We want to make sure that our battery life is at least a day. I won't have to charge several times a day. Yet, you know, we want all this fantastic functionality, and we're probably going to be using algorithms on our phones, such as, you know, image recognition, machine learning, and so on, which make the applications even more powerful from, you know, functionality point of view, but also consume more power from an electronic point of view. And we really need to look at all the ways which we can make the OS more efficient. Provide tools for application designers so that they don't inadvertently consume more power than they need to. And also, you know, tools which continuously monitor power and perhaps even, you know, send feedback to the application designers so that they can then release the next version, which, you know, fixes some of the issues which have been discovered. So, so I think, you know, that will be an area of hot research, and it will be one almost of a necessity, because all the big companies that are selling phone OSs and phone hardware will take advantage of, you know, any ideas that come along and be trying to roll out solutions in these areas.
So, Roy, please overview your views on mobile applications in middleware.
Well, I think we're in an interesting time in the development of mobile applications. So we're seeing, obviously, a large number of apps for things like the Apple iPhone and the Android OS that are being created using toolkits, which are basically relatively walled gardens, you know, for a particular operating system. People work within the development environment for that that technology, and they create the app and they put it out there. And, you know, some of those apps are going to web services and they're getting information and displaying it in a very customized way. And it's obviously caught on. You know, there are hundreds of thousands of these apps which have been created mainly by the developer community. Some are free, some are being charged for, and that obviously helps that there's potentially a reward for somebody puts the energy and design into, you know, a good, high-quality app. And most organizations and banks and museums and the like, you know, are creating custom apps for their own business, which is also very exciting. So the other alternative to mobile apps is the whole notion of web apps, you know, web services, things that we're used to, you know, in terms of surfing the web on a desktop, except clearly for the mobile phone, they need to be much smaller and customized for the tiny display in terms of font sizes, graphics, how many buttons you put on a page, what is the target size for controlling those buttons, and so on. But the intriguing thing about web apps is that there are a huge number of tools which are general purpose, which have been, you know, honed over the years of the mid-90s, you know, to where we are now. So it's 15 years of development of these tools. JavaScript, HTML5, obviously being the latest technology, which is going to impact this area. So the result is you can build very powerful applications now with HTML5, and it's going to get better. Not quite as powerful as some of the customized development kits that you get for, you know, say an Apple or an Android phone, but at some point it may be very similar. It may be just as good. And you have the advantage that no matter what phone you're on, no matter what hardware you're on, if you're working through the browser, you can access the same technology. It's just a web page which gets rendered on your device. It's going to be an interesting battle, I think, over the next few years as to which one wins out and whether, in fact, although there has been this huge push into the design of mobile applications right now, customized mobile applications, we might see that pendulum swing back towards web applications as the tools get better and people enjoy the flexibility of, you know, basically they work across any machine. You don't need to create a new app for every new kind of phone and phone environment that's out there.
And what is the status of wireless and mobile technologies?
Well, again, all wireless technologies are improving. You know, we've seen the progression of generations of wireless technology in terms of the metropolitan area. Wireless technologies like initially the 1G phones, and then the 2G, the 2.5G, and then with 3G, you know, and now with 4G coming along, released in some places, you know, we're going to be getting a couple of gigabits a second, and 4G has, you know, is a technology which can be improved upon, and you know, some predictions are that you might even in some cases in the distant future get 100 gigabits per second. Though obviously a lot of these numbers depend on whether you're moving, whether you're sharing the network with other people, and so on. But clearly it's an exciting time, and we're not at the end of the story yet. There's a lot of growth to go. And of course, you know, as we're experiencing this kind of growth, applications adapt to take advantage of the additional bandwidth. So if you, for instance, to give an example, if you were doing some image recognition on a high-quality photograph that you'd taken on your phone, if you've got that kind of bandwidth within a space of a short period of time, you can move that picture up to the cloud, to a cloud service. You can do the recognition there, and you can ship back the results. So it changes the game from what you could do locally to what you can do remotely. And this, I think, will open up a lot of opportunities, because as soon as you can get data, high-quality data, image data, even video data, from your phone into the cloud, then you can apply an enormous amount of computing power. You can divide, often, you know, image recognition problems can be divided into parts, and you can separate the parts into a lot of parallel computers to decrease the total computation time that the user sees. So we might see our phones become surprisingly capable as a result of that. In terms of the mobile technologies, you know, almost all technology still has opportunities for improvement. The processor technologies, as I mentioned earlier, they're becoming multi-processor system. Storage, we're seeing more and more exponentially growing flash memory incorporated into the devices. So you better store more locally. That means you can cache more data. You can carry things with you that you might need rather than you must have. And if you can carry things with you, then the access time to get that data will go down, because it's already on your device. You just need to access it. The local wireless technologies on these devices are also increasing in speed. So, you know, by this I mean Wi-Fi integrated, as well as having the cellular network. With Wi-Fi, you've got local connectivity. You've probably got more control over the bandwidth in that, you know, for instance, if it's at home, you've got access to most of the bandwidth. Some of those technologies are also going through a next generation of design. We might see next generation Wi-Fi with, say, you know, 2 or 3 gigabits of bandwidth between the phone and the access point in your house. Obviously, the wired connection also needs to be able to keep up if you're going to get that kind of data rate to the cloud services. But even between the computers in your home means that you can send large, high-def videos between these devices in relatively short periods of time. So I think, you know, it's a great time to be alive in the mobile world, because you're at a time of tremendous innovation. All the technologies are basically on a curve for improvement, and phones are going to get a lot more exciting in the next few years.
Now, Roy, you're sort of the master of all things in this whole area, this whole domain. So where specifically can one find the best resources for mobility?
Well, as an academic, I think, you know, the best resources are the premier conferences and the proceedings for those conferences. So, you know, we're looking at MobiCom, MobiSys, MobiHawk, Sensis. They're all at UbiCom. They're all, you know, ACM sponsored conferences. The reason that we sponsor these conferences is because of the high quality associated with them. So the standards are high. They're all, well, at least, you know, most of them are single track. So you have all the community, you know, looking at all the papers during the conferences. And I think that has great value. The selection rates for those conferences are small. So, you know, you may be down at 20% or less for the acceptance rate compared to the number of papers submitted. I think the other, you know, great resource is the ACM and IEEE Digital Library, which are repositories for all of these things. So I think that's, you know, that's, if you like, the resources that the community should take advantage of. There's nothing that beats going to these conferences themselves and, you know, interacting with other researchers, particularly in their poster sessions and some of the demo sessions, where you see ideas which are just in the early stages of formation. You know, they'll probably be turned into full-blown papers in a year or two. But you're seeing an idea as it's sort of coming to fruition, and it's a very exciting environment to be in. And I think, you know, in one of those sessions, you can learn a lot very quickly about where researchers think the future is.
You know, you mentioned the ACM Digital Library, and I know that's, you know, the ACM Digital Library is one of sort of the featured areas within TechBacks. And when is your ACM Mobility TechBack going to be released, and you're chairing this TechBack?
We expect it to be released within the next couple of months. All of the text for it has been written. It's going through a final editing phase. There's a lot of formatting issues with all the different references and so on. Make sure it's uniform, and there's also checking to make sure that we haven't got any bad links. And making sure that all the sources of papers and materials, because all the materials come from all over. They're not just ACM. But in some cases there are classic papers where the only place we can find them is on somebody's personal website. So all of those things need to be checked and make sure that we have legitimate access to them. And we expect by the end of Q4 that should be online.
Well, it sounds like an excellent resource, because your team, which you've chaired, has done a tremendous job in finding the best resources for those busy professionals that are out there.
Yeah, the team has been fantastic. The core of the team has been the Sig Mobile Executive Committee. So these are all of the people elected into roles within Sig Mobile. And we decided that this was going to be something that was worth putting time into, and everybody took some piece of this and worked hard at producing the references and the summaries. And I think all their hard work has paid off, and we're in good shape right now.
Now, what are the top best practices of mobility that you wish to share?
Well, the concept of a best practice could be taken in various ways. Certainly, if you are designing an application, you could look at the best practices for how you design that. So, as an example, a lot of applications for smartphones use a web service of some kind. So they're linked with a web service. And of course, any designer will want to understand how an application is being used. So that means they'll log information about what's going on with the app and what the state of the app is and what information was perhaps entered into the app. So in terms of best practices here, I think the key thing is you've got to really respect the privacy of the people using it. It's very key that you let anyone who's using it know what you're logging and how you're going to use that data. And if possible, design it in a way which it's anonymized, so that you may be getting the gross statistic about how a particular feature of an application is being used from your logs, but you can't tell exactly who used the feature. And you should try and anonymize user IDs in those logs, so that even if you're looking manually at a line which is entered into the log, it doesn't reveal anything about where that particular piece of data came from, either the person or the phone associated with the person. This is sometimes challenging. There are lots of ways, unfortunately, that you can combine information to infer other information. Otherwise, you might put infer who somebody is because you know of a couple of locations which the phone was sighted at or used at. And if you look at all the people it could be, there's probably only a small number, and perhaps it may even put the finger on you completely. So it is challenging. But in terms of best practice, I think people should be very aware that this is an important thing. If the user community continue to use certain apps, may well depend on how well you've taken this into account and how well you've engineered your app to respect these issues, which I think are coming to the fore in many people's minds now. And you see this in the press as they respond to different things that people have found in phones. They find that things are being logged when perhaps they shouldn't be. Sometimes it's not an issue of malice. It's just that an engineer was trying to figure something out. He inserted some logging features and then never took them out. Basically forgot to take them out afterwards. So I didn't think it was important that they got taken out. And as a result, the logs are full of private information. So these are the issues which can happen. And I think going forward, there will be some very strict and worthy guidelines for how you go about building these things.
Now, you touched on some of this earlier, but do you have any additional comments you want to make about the security challenges in mobility?
Well, security, as in all computer systems, is a moving target. And there are well-known techniques for looking for signatures of viruses and so on. And these techniques are being applied to mobile phones, but as soon as we find solutions to some of these problems, we'll see new attacks formed. And I think that's just going to be a fact of life. We have to accept that this is an ongoing battle, an ongoing challenge. So, you know, I think going forward, we'll get smarter at building detection mechanisms so that although we can't protect you against something, we can detect if something strange is happening very quickly. And, you know, this may involve machine learning techniques. It may involve, you know, some subtle techniques like, monitoring precise power used by your phone and, using the power profile as an indication along with processor activity that something is malicious that's operating on your phone. So I think, you know, it's going to be, I don't think we could have this interview in 10 years time and I'll say, you know, we got it. We finally nailed it. I don't think that will ever happen. Because the people who are interested in creating these kind of attacks are very creative themselves. And the solutions to the problems are creative as a way of combating that. But then you just move to another level of attack, and you're back to square one again. So it's not a great answer, I know, in this area. But I think that a lot of people will be thinking about these solutions. And I expect, you know, for many of the large institutions that generate apps, they'll have practices in place. They'll have the knowledge of how you should use security and what things you need to put in place to detect breaches of security that will be alerted to the problems fast enough to better deal with them.
Now, can you describe some areas of controversy or much discussion in the areas that you research?
Well, I think there's always discussion about how technologies will be used and whether they'll be used for, you know, good or evil purposes. This whole notion of location tracking obviously can be used for, you know, one for augmentation of social networks where it can be used by intelligence services to track you when you're not really wanting to be tracked or even perhaps, you know, technically shouldn't be tracked. So I think there was a philosophical debate about what these capabilities bring. When you introduce a new sensor to a phone, what does it, you know, what are the implications? And I find myself in lots of debates about the implications of adding a new capability. You know, take the example of NFC, for instance, that we also mentioned earlier, being used for electronic payments. And I could just swipe my phone by a little pad in a store and I can buy a product. So, you know, is this something which is going to lead to lots of, attacks on the phone in that I'll be tricked into bringing my phone next to things which cause a transaction to occur without me being aware of it and so on. So, you know, I can understand people's concerns, and most of the major concerns can be addressed by good engineering and good design. I'm sure there'll be mistakes which are made along the way, and then we'll learn from them and things will improve. So I think the debate is good. You never want to sort of shy away from the debate. I think the practice of actually trying it teaches us a lot more. And as long as we're prepared to respond quickly, then we'll be in good shape.
Now, in your research, then, what are the top ways of measuring success?
Well, the gold standard for success is that you somehow get your application or technology or device out into the hands of users, and if the user community explodes, then you have a success. I mean, there's sort of no doubt. It's purely determined by adoption. And, you know, perhaps it was an old style of design where you might give your device or mobile application to small communities of focus groups and do lots of sort of internal analysis, and then eventually you release the technology. In the modern way of doing things is that you make sure it's relatively solid, but then you give it out to the user community and let them be your real testers and get the feedback from them. It's getting, you know, these days with the internet, you can distribute an application to, well, almost anybody who has a smartphone in the world, and they can be trying it out. Information can be being logged. You can get personal feedback from them if they care to fill in questionnaires or, you know, respond to a general request for feedback. So I think, you know, it's a very different world from the way it was, say, 20 years ago when people thought about building applications. And really this is, I think generally accepted by most of the people in the computer community at this point.
Yeah, in your current research, what are the top challenges and top opportunities? And then as a sort of a follow-up question, and I don't know if this can be answered, how will the challenges be solved and the opportunities be actioned?
Well, top challenges are top challenges. I think I'd already, mentioned some again with security and power and so on. Solutions to these problems are not going to be easy. The difficult problems, if I knew the answers, they really wouldn't be problems because people would be on it straight away. I think these are areas where there are a number of things that can be done which will improve the general problem. So, in security, we talked about, ways of monitoring, building best practices about how you build an application. You can imagine standard libraries, for security that are well tried and tested that, use encryption techniques, which are people have examined for long periods of time and ensure there are no buffer overflow attacks or all these kind of issues. So, so things will harden, if you like, over a period of time when these things will be in place. So I think that's the answer, that, there's motivation to solve these problems, but it's going to be a long road, but we're going to make continuous progress because there's so much feedback that's happening and so many things that are being tried on a weekly basis to solve these problems.
What specific technology should IT practitioners be embracing today and in 2 and 5 years?
So the IT practitioners are, I'm imagining groups of people who are perhaps employed by large companies and are trying to figure out, what the enterprise strategy is. And certainly I've come across, many stories over recent years where, individual contributors within a company are bringing in their mobile devices and saying, I want to better read my email on this, and why can't I? So there's a lot of pressure, to move away from, traditional techniques of accessing corporate data and make them mobile. And I think most of them, have, been through this and are already trying to figure out what their mobile strategy is. So my first advice to any practitioner, if you haven't got a mobile strategy yet, certainly think about how you're going to create one. And secondly, if you have a mobile strategy for today's phones, then that may not be an appropriate strategy for tomorrow's phones as storage changes. In other words, you can store more on the devices, or maybe you want to have a policy where you store more in the cloud and take advantage of the high-speed networks to access some of that data. So I think the important thing for the IT professional is to realize that it's a continuous process of innovation in the smartphone and mobile arena, and that you've got to track the technologies that are feeding into the phones and the capabilities. And it's probably essential to go to any of the developer conferences to understand what's coming out, and really keep tabs on what the next couple of generations of phones might contain, which you can glean from some of the conference material, you can glean from some of the various websites which sort of track rumors that companies are developing certain features or integrating certain technologies into their phones. You do all this basically to avoid being surprised by the contributor that comes into their office and says, I want to do this. I think that's the only way. You just got to stay ahead of the game and use as many of the future-looking forums as you can to try and figure out what to do.
Now, I guess that's your answer to the question really applies also to businesses, because I was going to do a follow-up question, like what specific technologies should businesses be embracing today and into the future? But I guess it really is the same sort of areas that practitioners should be looking at, or do you have additional comments to make?
No, I think it's the same areas. I think no matter where you stand, technology innovation is very rapid, and there isn't kind of, if you're in this particular category of job, you only look ahead this much. If you're in another category, you look ahead this much. I think if you want to be educated about where things are going, you have to take the broader picture and really try and track not just the developer conferences, but some of the academic areas as well, because it isn't long. The gap between an idea in a university being turned into an idea in a product is getting smaller and smaller. I wouldn't like to put a time scale on it, but I just see it from So the things I see discussed at conferences to when I start seeing products which contain these ideas, and it just seems to be more and more rapid.
Roy, I look at your background, and you know, you've got something like, what, over 85 patent filings. You're a fellow of the IEEE and the ACM, just a remarkable international standing. So I'm thinking you're perfectly placed to look into your crystal ball and predict the future. Or can you? Can you make some predictions for the future in a more general sense, their implications and how we can best prepare?
Well, there's one area of technology that I think are going to be very important, and that's the ability to move computation around as a single unit. So this is something that we haven't really seen yet, and perhaps I should explain a little bit more about what it's about. So in the world of data centers, there's a technology which is called the virtual machine, which allows you to encapsulate an entire operating system, a set of applications, running applications, within a machine, and you know, create an image of it, and then move it to another computer and have it run there as if nothing had happened. And that's called virtual machine migration. So data centers use this to basically balance the loads between different servers and services within all the machines they have in the network, so that you don't get one machine that's being hammered by the population you know, using a particular application or service compared to another, and you try and create as much computing power as is available to solve the problem. So phones are getting to a point now where we can run full VMs in the phone. And that means that we can move your phone computation out of the phone to other computers which are nearby. Or particularly, you know, you might find that there are, you know, this is really looking to the future here. This is kind of a vision statement, and it's one that was pioneered by Professor Satcher at CMU, Carnegie Mellon University. It's the notion that you might have, if you like, some level of distribution of the data center, so that there are some computing resources which are quite close to you. So you might, for instance, find in a Starbucks that not only is the Wi-Fi service there, but also there's, in one of the cupboards there is a whole bunch of computers which you could move computation from your phone to those other computers. And these would be more powerful than your phone, and they may accelerate some kinds of applications. So, for instance, translation of one language into another may be done very quickly by these computers, and then, you know, the result is spewed back to you on your phone. And the reason for it, you know, if you're wanting it to be quick, is that you're trying to interact with somebody in another language at that site. I'm just picking language translation because it's, you know, it's one of those highly computational tasks. And, you know, there are plenty of other examples where you might be analyzing pictures, or processing video in some way. And the advantage of having the computation nearby is that you've only got one hop between you and it. So, assuming you've got enough bandwidth, and we are talking about a future with much higher bandwidth local area networks of, you know, several gigabits per second, we can move the audio or the video or some imagery very quickly to those devices, have it processed there, and then move it back. And sometimes the best method for moving an application is to move the application encapsulated in a VM. So you've got the data, the app, the operating system, everything, and it all moves to one of these nearby computational devices. It's executed, and then the results come back. And, you know, you just think about it as an extension of cloud services, except part of the cloud has moved to near your access point, or even may be part of your access point. And there may be a hierarchy as well, right? You may move some of the computation to the access point, and then some computation further into the cloud services if you need additional databases or other information which is only contained in the cloud. So this is you know, this is a new paradigm. It's basically one which would accelerate the amount of computing power you can apply to a problem, augments it, and hopefully it would allow us to solve a lot of problems in a much shorter period of time, which means that on a sort of human scale, human interaction scale, that some of those things might be possible. So you might have an augmented environment where you're processing audio and video information, providing more valuable information back to the user in real time without noticeable delays, which would you know, be an impediment for using it.
Now we have a series of questions that are sort of, in a way, outside of the mobility space, and just kind of more broader questions. And the first one is, What are your thoughts on computing as a recognized profession like medicine and law or engineering with demonstrated professional development, adherence to code of ethics, and recognized credentials?
So I think originally computer science was kind of, an offshoot profession from mathematics. So some people would say the failed mathematicians became computer scientists, or perhaps the failed engineers became computer scientists. And perhaps there was a time where the discipline as a whole didn't have much rigor to it. But now, it really is a very rich subject, and there's a huge amount which we've understood over the last 30, 40 years. The computer science curriculums are a significant body of work to get a degree in computer science, and requires quite a lot of skill and intuition, understanding of some key concepts in order to do well. So I think we're now at a point, and probably have been for many years, where computer science has, the chops to be one of these highly respected disciplines. I think one of the problems that we see, though, is that it's not treated very well in school. So, there aren't many advanced placement courses, AP courses in high school that have any real value that students would want to sign on to. In other words, I don't think the universities consider the AP courses to be of a standard which would differentiate you in terms of admission to the school or university. So we need to address that. And it's really a question of improving the quality of those courses, getting the universities on board, and making sure that they know what the expectations are if people take those exams. And then, of course, when students understand that universities hold them in high esteem, then they'll begin to see signing on for the courses. And I think this will help, and more people will move towards the computer science discipline. And in the future, hopefully we'll see, an even larger body of students who take this on as their profession.
You have traveled broadly and for some time, and from your travels and work, do you have any interesting stories to share? Perhaps something amusing, surprising, unexpected, or amazing?
I have one sort of period in my life which amused me, particularly when I worked on the active badge location technologies, the in-building location system. This was a story which the press generally loved. I mean, it was a story which they could come in and see a group of 20 or 30 people wearing these badges and seeing the system work. And inevitably, they would probe on questions like, so are there sensors in the bathrooms? I mean, you could almost guarantee they would ask this question. So I got myself ready for these kinds of questions. But the one that really I think just went too far, but also is kind of amusing that they saw it as a target to make it this way, was with the San Jose Mercury News. And we had a reporter come in and did the usual sort of question time. They looked at the system, they took some photographs and so on. And then they wrote an article which appeared in the Sunday newspaper. And in the color supplement on the front page of the color cover was a picture of a boss in graphical form, which small body and a very long neck that came out, and on top of the neck was this giant eyeball, and the whole title of the supplement was "The Boss That Never Blinks," and they had made this into a totally sensational story about the active badge system, how it was destroying people's privacy, how terrible it was that these phone systems were routing phone calls to the right place and so on, and all the terrible things it could be used for. And by then I had always given a very balanced story about how the technology could be used for bad purposes, could be used for good purposes, and that we were aware of all the issues. And it really comes down to a policy decision, possibly even, if you imagine these kind of things on a national scale, legislation which governs how this information is being used. But they ignored all of that and just wrote the sensational story. So at one point it's sort of striking and unfortunate. In another viewpoint, it's amusing that they would just build a story around this. So the lesson to be learned here is that always be very, very careful about talking to the press when any technology is involved.
Well, I guess it did bring attention to your group.
Well, there's always an upside. Certainly a lot more people, I think, were aware of the Active Badge Project after that.
Now, we're down to our last question, and this is where I turn the tables, and that is, if you were conducting this interview, what one or more questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
So this is, this is a question which I guess is all hard. I certainly feel that, the security and power issues are, at the fore. And if I had a mobile phone as an interviewer, I'd be, asking questions about, what kind of improvements would I see and so on. And I think we've largely covered some of those things. Perhaps there's one area which I think is in question at the moment. It's an area I talked about with NFC payments and so on. It's an interesting, decision point or inflection point is, might we move away from credit cards completely and just use our mobile phones for payment? So that would be one of the key questions that I would be asking, because you certainly see a lot of press about NFC at the moment. If you read the right technical press, you see that it's a big debate as to what standard people use for payments. Even if you have NFC, you could use a number of standards on top of it. Whether people will like it or whether they won't trust the technology. Could it just be that they're suspicious that there's more ways you can defraud such a system? So I think that's one of these big questions at the moment is, even if we give people the ability to pay with NFC using your phone as a wallet, might we be in a situation in 10 years' time where we have no credit cards, or will we be doing exactly what we do today and looking back on NFC as a quaint new idea that never really made it? I would like to think that it's going to be a successful technology because, the beauty of being to get rid of maybe 10 cards that I carry around on a regular basis, and if I look through some of the cards I have in my desk as well, and to have all of those instantiated in the phone, I think would be a much nicer capability. But it's one of those things, very hard to predict, and you'll probably have to wait the 10 years to really get an answer.
Well, Roy, again, it's been a real pleasure talking with you today. You are a highly recognized international expert in a number of areas, and as I mentioned, highly regarded. So, we are indeed fortunate to have you come in and do this interview, and thank you for sharing your substantial wisdom and expertise with our audience.
Thank you. I certainly enjoyed the time.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Dr. Roy Wandt, international, much-awarded top researcher in mobile and ubiquitous computing, chair ACM SIG Mobile, and chair Mobility Tech Pack.